There's no smoking in this building, Miss Trammell.
What are you gonna do? Charge me with smoking?
Hey everybody, welcome to the show. Thanks for listening as always. Today we're talking about Basic Instinct from 1992, a movie that made had a lot of controversy that we decided ultimately wasn't worth the fuss.
Definitely not. A lot of effort across the board. It inspired protests, and probably not for the reasons you might assume.
Yeah. It's right. Obviously we'll get into it, but it's I knew it was controversial. It's not hard to figure out because there's a lot of sexual content in there, so there's always that. But like, this really drew some this really pissed people off. Is that funny? It's only funny because, like I said, just I was thinking about how we said it. Ultimately, maybe it wasn't worth the fuss.
Yeah, absolutely.
Just for what's ultimately kind of a stupid movie.
Is it the most parodied scene in movie history?
God, it's really, really up there. And it definitely is, of course, the scene with Sharon Stone interrogated by the police. And
I'm sure you all know the one we mean.
Her legs with the thing there. And yeah, it's certainly like the thing when it starts up. I hadn't seen the movie before this. Mm-hmm. And it starts up. You're like, oh, the scene is starting. You can just tell even before the thing happens, the look of it and everything. It's just like I could think of a few off the top of my head, but then you also are just like, when you were looking it up, there's so many. And I've probably seen a lot. It's just in your head, you know. That's a good question, though. It's definitely one of the most parodied scenes. What else is there? Stuff from, like, Wizard of Oz? I was going to ask you.
Yeah, you're right. The witch melting. I'm melting.
Yeah.
That's been in 8 million things.
Right, yeah. And I wonder if certain, like, maybe Hitchcock, like Psycho or stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But it's definitely up there. Certainly,
It's quiet. It's a dirty reference.
It's pretty, it's... I don't know. I'm sure when they were made, we talked about this a lot. I was like, man, they really just made this to be like, man, people are going to fucking freak out when they see this. Like, there's an element to that. You might argue that it's immature. I might even agree. I don't know. But, you know, it's like, yeah, we're going to have a movie and people are going to be having sex. You're not going to know if they're going to kill each other or not. It's just like, it's all very,
To give a nice little overview, maybe a hook is, it's the scene that got one person a role in Jurassic Park, and another one, their custody of their children taken away.
Mm-hmm.
So,
if
you can believe it, maybe same we scene. Should bum bum bum. Yeah. I don't know. Throw a little music cue in there. Okay, so Basic Instinct is about. When her boyfriend is murdered with an ice pick mid-coitus, a trashy crime novelist becomes the prime suspect.
I'm so jealous that you got to say mid-coitus and I didn't.
I'm sure you'll have many opportunities. And there was one.
Yeah, I just did it. Complaining about it. Yeah.
So it was directed by Paul Verhoeven.
Mm-hmm.
You might know from directing RoboCop, Total Recall, Showgirls, and Starship Troopers. Other things, too, but those are the ones that I wanted to mention.
For sure.
And it was written by Joe Esterhaas, who also wrote Flashdance, and he and Paul Verhoeven would collaborate again on Showgirls.
Yeah, not to, I don't know any details about this at all, but Paul Verhoeven is making these incredible, like, very, I guess you'd say very blatantly layered sci-fi movies like RoboCop, you know?
And Total Recall.
And then he got mixed up with Joe Esterhaas, and he made Basic Instinct, and he made Showgirls in a row. And then, I don't know what happened there, but then back to Starship Troopers, again, very, like, blatantly layered sci-fi movie. So yeah, they definitely, they fell in with each other. And Basic Instinct was a hit, and Showgirls has become something of a cult hit, right? So
very much
their
so.
Collaboration is it endures.
I think Showgirls has a reputation as being known for the worst movie ever made.
It's got that. There's yeah.
And
yeah,
if
yeah.
you've seen it, it's an earned title, I think.
Is it not a hoot though? Right.
Ah, yeah. It's a kind of a slog. It's long.
You're right. There's moments that it's like absurd and over the top. But you're right, as like a feature film, to sit down and watch it as kind of a gag or something is really... Do you remember that there was a crazy... I might cut this, but there was a crazy... some cut they did for TV where they just like drew over some of the nudity.
Oh my God.
And it looks awful. Like it looks like hand-drawn.
Draw over with what?
Like these girls have bikinis now. And so they're not naked dancers or something.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
That's awesome. I'd like to look that up.
Yeah.
Oh, before we go into who else was involved, should we talk about what we thought of it?
Yeah, why don't we sneak that in here? Okay. Because it is one, it's not often that we come to it like, I watched it for the first time, you didn't. You watched it again. Mm-hmm. You've seen it a few years ago. You watched it one day while I was at work.
Yeah, it was, it's been on, I've had an ever-evolving list of like horror movies to watch every October. And Basic Instinct is just one of those movies that was in my purview as a horror movie, specifically because of Scream. It's referenced in Scream. We talked about this the other day, but Tatum, Rose McGowan's character, says when they're discussing who it could possibly be the killer, she says the killer could easily be female. Basic Instinct.
Mm-hmm.
So that's interesting. That was my only.
Yeah. It's kind of, it's like a horror adjacent maybe or something, in the sense of it's like a true crimey, there's a killer. We joked about how it wasn't too far off from just being like a long Law and Order episode.
Yeah, completely. Down to like every person that the detective is running around asking questions of. Homicide detective.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Very serious mm-hmm. thing. You'd think somebody would stop washing their car.
Yeah, people just can't be bothered to stop whatever preoccupied thing they're doing. Yeah.
Just like, I know that you said you're from Homicide, and you're obviously asking questions related to a murder, but I really need to get this fucking bar top clean.
Right, exactly, so. Yeah.
And then obviously we talked about how it's just one of those movies where even if you've not seen it, you know what to picture if you see that scene referenced.
Yeah, I knew that.
You know what it is.
Yeah, I knew that Sharon Stone was being interrogated by the police, and then all that, the leg business happens, the funny stuff. And right, so you have like a basic idea of it.
So when I watched it in 2019,
okay,
by myself, I never thought I'd revisit it. Because I
thought it was a one and done.
I rarely leave Letterboxd reviews. I like to log what I watch. It's like an app where you can keep track of what movies you watch.
Yeah, so you log stuff. You don't always feel compelled to write a thing.
Yeah. It's more just like for my own personal
memory.
It's
cool to look back even in instances like this. Whether you wrote somewhere, now in this case you did, but you go, oh, I watched that in 2019.
Yeah.
How about that? How do you like that?
And I was compelled to leave a review. I left half a star.
Yeah.
This may be, no hyperbole, the worst movie I've ever seen.
There you go.
And,
pretty blunt. Do you stand by that? Here we are a few years later.
I'm trying to think what else I've seen since then.
You've seen Gotti.
Oh, boy.
I think Gotti's worse than this.
Absolutely.
Gotti's way worse than this.
Yeah, because Gotti was just inexplicable. We covered that in episode 2. If you've not
heard
that one yet, it's weirder than I could possibly explain. Gotti
is, you know, with all due respect, it's like a I don't know, it's a sort of patch together. Let's call it barely a movie. I don't know.
At least there's no sexual assault scene. That's not acknowledged as sexual assault.
Yeah, I guess, you know, there's pros and cons, right? If
spoiler alert.
Gotti is a worse movie that might be less upsetting, truth be told, you know?
Yeah.
If that's not your style of movie with like, you know what we were talking about? Sorry to jump in or whatever, but like, I don't know anything about 50 Shades of Grey, but I wondered if this movie had like a similar thing of just the sense that it like exposed some mainstream audiences to kind of some like not 100% conventional sex scenes and things like that. And if you're coming to it from like, oh, I heard this movie's hardcore S&M, you'd go, okay, it's really not. But it is also, you know, like again, like a bit beyond what a lot of like R-rated movies would do in these sultry sort of thrillers.
That's actually in part in addition to the a litany of other things that we've briefly touched on. Its legacy is sort of opening the door to like naughtier bedroom stuff.
Its legacy is one of nudity. Just say it.
It's a fuck picture. I'm sorry.
It's the beaver picture, as we've come to know it around here. So,
oh, I will read a line from the Wikipedia page that speaks to this. It says, since its release, the film has undergone a critical reevaluation. It has become recognized for its groundbreaking depictions of sexuality in mainstream Hollywood cinema and was described by one scholar as a neo-film noir masterpiece that plays with and transgresses the narrative rules of film noir.
Okay.
Because you have the femme fatale character.
Yeah.
But then it's like, well, what if we got to see her tits?
Yeah.
A lot.
Yeah, it's 1992. You know, Alfred Hitchcock would have showed tits. He just couldn't. So that's the thing. It's like, even a movie like this, that's easy to dismiss. We were knocking it and, you know, it ain't, I don't think it's great, but it is just like, it's like kind of a procedural Law and Order, whatever. At the end of the day, even some schlocky movie was made by like absolute like film dorks that grew up. So well, my point being, it's like, it is this like Hitchcockian sort of thing. And there's obvious nods to it and everything, but it is also again, like the thing with the famous leg uncrossing scene. I don't know if Hitchcock would have done that stuff.
And because it's only known as the movie with the leg crossing scene, I didn't realize that there is a lot of graphic sex.
That's there's a lot of just other like sex scenes and everything too.
And that leg long thing. Yeah. So long, minutes long.
There's a thing, we have it in here somewhere where it's like, you know, they cut out, I don't know, I forget what. 35 to 45 seconds to get to their R rating, which it's like, wow, I guess you just put in like, you know, 10 minutes and you'll take what you can get or something. And it's like, okay, 35 to 45. Okay, cool. Cause like you got a lot in there still. I'm sure they probably saw it as what they, oh, this is travesty, my art and everything. But they got a lot in there.
Yeah. Oh,
and
boy.
In today's modern resolutions, I don't know what it was like on, I mean, it had on the big screen. I don't know. It probably was one thing, but on years of VHS tapes and cable reruns. I don't know if you saw it. You know, we watched it. It's on Prime for free right now, presently.
Yeah.
You see some things. So of course, there's some blatant nudity, but there's some...
Some shadows.
Some shadows, some moving and turning and vantages, things happening. It's not since we watched our Blu-ray of The Terminator, and when Arnold comes to Earth naked, you really can see how naked he is in a way I wasn't aware of.
Probably nobody anticipated being able to see that.
It's just a different... Yeah. So
the whole thing.
Yeah.
So that being said, is there a reason why you didn't ever seek it out? Just one of those?
Yeah, not like really.
You had seen it already?
Yeah, I guess it's just like, it's not hard to tell. So from a child's perspective, like again, when I saw all kinds of movies as a kid. That's just not hard to peg as like, I don't want to watch this. I certainly don't watch this with my parents. I don't want to ask my parents if I can rent this. I don't want to watch this if my parents walk in. It's not impossible that I would have caught it on TV or something and watched it, but that just, I guess, never really happened, you know? And then that thing does happen where you just feel like, not that you've seen it, but you're so familiar with that, I don't know, maybe it's not, you feel like less compelled to seek out this whole movie that's around, it's kind of like a meme before that's what we called it, you know? But it's like, you don't see a meme and go, oh, I should watch a whole episode of 30 Rock with Steve Buscemi where he says, how do you do, fellow kids? You should, because it's great. But it almost just exists as that.
Right.
You know, so I just never thought to see it. Certainly wasn't opposed. And then, like you and you said, you don't want to revisit it. It's like the bad movie fan in me. When you had such a reaction to it, I wasn't like, oh, we got to watch that. But, you know, I noted and I was like, some of the things you said. And they've been, at the time you took a couple of little videos because you're like, I think you might have posted them on your Instagram story or something. But at the same time, it was just like, look at this weird line or this awkward stretcher flying around in a hanging from a helicopter and all these funny around the edges little bits.
Look at these choices.
Yeah.
So not 90 seconds into the movie, you have a room full of detectives examining a murder scene. And one of them says, cum stain. I'm like, this is the primer. This is, I mean, it literally opens with a sex scene. Sex murder scene.
I was going to say, when you said like the plot synopsis and say when her boyfriend is murdered with an ice pick mid-coitus, that is the opening scene.
That's the opening scene.
That's it. And then like he's also 90 seconds in where, and the thing is like, I think Paul Verhoeven's a great director. So there's these great scenes that are very cinematically well done. People are, you know, it's rad. It's like these long, wide shots. It's shot by Jan de Bont, so you know it's going to be fantastic. And everyone's like coming in and they have their lines and just like they're like these police in their station scenes or even the other, you know, like it's all like blocked out and directed really well, but like they're performing really weird material. So it's, yeah, like guy steps in and says his thing about the cum stains everywhere. It's just it's a scene, man.
He left the club with his girlfriend about midnight. It's the last time anybody saw him.
What was it?
Ice pick. Left it on the coffee table in the living room.
There's cum stains all over the sheets.
So we mentioned it was Jan de Bont is a cinematographer on Basic Instinct. He also shot Die Hard and The Hunt for Red October. He went on to direct Speed and Twister. And he has, to this date, shot 6 different Paul Verhoeven movies.
They're a duo. I always love those. I love those two movies. Like growing up, Speed and Twister were two big, like, you know, big crazy movies you see in the theater, and they kind of blow your mind. And they still hold up. They're both really fun, I think.
Yeah, I agree.
So, like, he's definitely, you see, that's like one trajectory people take to director. It's like if you, it's almost like playing sports. You do director of photography for a while. Eventually, they're like, hey, man, I think I want to try being a regular director. They're like, all right, direct a movie. And then sometimes it takes, you know. So good for Jan.
And, of course, our leads are Michael Douglas as the detective, mm-hmm. the homicide detective, and Sharon Stone as the trashy crime novelist mm-hmm. in where you don't know if she's a murderer or not.
Don't know, because you see the mid-coitus. You see the coitus and the murder, but I think... You don't see the face real clear, right?
Right. You just see a blonde lady.
A blonde lady. She's definitely got a butt. That is established. She's got breasts. She has an ice pick. And she... It's interesting that as a kid, you don't always know... Like when I was... This is like the movie... Sharon Stone wasn't much of a huge star before this.
Correct.
And it was definitely, as it happens once in a while... A movie like this with a role like this and the performance that is good, you just have a new movie star.
Yeah, very much so.
But Michael Douglas, sorry to jump all over, Michael Douglas wanted it to be more of a movie star in the first place, right?
Yeah, he was bummed out that that he couldn't get any A-list actress to agree to do the role. They were all a little spooked away.
You had said when we were talking about that before that you said, like, I understand because it is like they were hanging their ass out there literally and metaphorically a little bit, right? Yeah. Where
he speaks to it. He said he didn't think Sharon Stone was a big enough name and he was determined to have another A-list actress to star opposite him. He said, I need someone to share the risks of this movie. I don't want to be up there all by myself. There's going to be a lot of shit flying around. And I think he might have meant something very specific when he said shit
I didn't mean like controversy, or does he just mean like, again, like we're going in, we're filming, Jan de Bont's crawling into bed with a camera and we're just flopping around in there.
You see a lot of Michael Douglas. It's more than I expected.
Yeah,
he's 47, I believe.
Yeah, you have a certain barometer of like, there's this much nudity that they do in an R-rated movie or like violence or whatever, you know, and it really trounces all over that. It's funny because he has a point and everything, but we just think it's funny. And a few things about that I think are funny. Just like he might have a point, but it's a tough look when you're also trying to get people to like do those scenes with you. Like, I think we need like, well, can we get one of the most beautiful women in the world? And then we were just having a lot of fun. Michael Douglas kind of comes from the school. I'll try this. I'll see how it goes. But like. I really am into doing like I like doing like a Jack Nicholson voice because I read a thing about Jack Nicholson, how he would try to stand out in a movie when he was doing smaller parts. If you just take the scene and you take your line and it's not that interesting, but you just slow it down a little bit, then it's like, whoa, everyone's like fucking hanging on this guy and he's not even doing the big monologue or the big scene stealing thing. But suddenly you're like, what's going on with this cat in this scene? Right. So I don't know if that's an impactful performance thing that other people did, because then we always joked about Christian Slater as kind of like a Jack Nicholson light.
When you get that completely doing Jack Nicholson.
When you tune that in your brain and you watch a young Christian Slater performance, you're like, oh, okay, this is like if Jack Nicholson was in a high school guy or something. Yeah, yeah. Hey, man, what's it like? What class are you in today, huh? I don't know how to do it more on the Christian Slater side, but Michael Douglas has a bit of that. There's a bit of a deliberate pacing or something to that. Like, hey, Michelle Pfeiffer, do you want to do a movie where we bone four times? I don't know if that works.
Kim Basinger said no. I can't do it. I'm trying.
I just think it's all going to sound like my Jack Nicholson, anything I try to do.
But they asked, they were turned down by a lot of actresses. So I said Kim Basinger because that's who Michael Douglas wanted. She was the first one to say no. He was cast early on.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then he also suggested Julia Roberts and Meg Ryan. They both said no. And then subsequently... production, Paul Verhoeven and producers were turned down by Michelle Pfeiffer, Gina Davis, Kathleen Turner, and Mariel Hemingway. And this is an incomplete list.
All of those people. It's just insane to think. It's weird. Like Meg Ryan doing the leg crossing scene.
I guess she did in the cut, not that many, well, like 10 years later.
Yeah.
Or when that one.
It's just, about 10, 11 or 10. I guess it's really just hard to picture anyone else. Julia Roberts is another one. It just seems like...
Why'd you even ask her? Are you joking?
Just if you ask, then it can be talked about forever like this, you know?
So funny.
All it says is, suggested Julia Roberts. That's just like, it's crazy.
He's just going through the magazine in his house, just circling...
Julia Roberts is fucking a guy and stabbing him with an ice pick. All naked half the movie. I don't know.
So obviously Michael Douglas eventually agreed or relented to Sharon Stone's casting, and she had previously played Arnold Schwarzenegger's wife in Total Recall.
So that was a pretty prominent, that was a big movie, a good role, not the lead by any stretch, but a pretty good part.
Yeah, and so she made an impression on Paul Verhoeven. He said, the face of Sharon Stone goes from diabolical evil to the most sweet and lovely expression as possible. That transition for me was so notable. The evil in her eyes changes into the love of her life in a couple seconds.
Yeah.
And he said that that look, that ability to change from like loving to evil pretty seamlessly is like why he wanted to cast her.
It makes sense if you look at just like that's exactly what she does in both movies, is kind of like switch gears or channel or, you know, like what am I revealing now or not? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty good. She goes on to be obviously maybe it goes without saying, maybe not, but just absolutely great in Casino a few years later.
Yeah, she won an Oscar for that, right?
Nominated. At least.
Great movie. And then also in there is this actor whose name I can't pronounce. Dzunda.
George Dzunda as Gus.
Gene Triplehorn and Wayne Knight. Newman
himself. But really, man, Newman... If you put up the numbers of Wayne Knight, you know, not that these are Wayne Knight-led movies, but if you put up the numbers of a Space Jam, Jurassic Park, Basic Instinct, anything else I might have forgotten.
JFK?
JFK, yeah. The receipts on this guy. Wayne Knight, I don't know. Maybe he's been in other movies that didn't really go off, too, but just saying he seems like a... Rip is going absolutely mad back there.
Yeah.
She got a cone on and she's trying to chew a bone. It's just a mess. But...
poor kid.
Yeah, and the Velcro is exposed on the outside of the cone, so she gets stuck on things. Not stuck, but she pulls it around. She can't find it.
She's innovating new ways to disrupt the podcast process.
Yeah.
It's pretty impressive.
We put the podcast cone on her head. No, unrelated.
So the budget for this movie was $49 million. I would imagine most of that went to covering Michael Douglas's phone bills. Begging actresses.
Yeah, this is the era of long distance still. That's a lot. 49 feels like a lot for like the early 90s.
Come on, just be in the picture.
Hey, Michael Douglas, did you see Wall Street? Well, why don't you watch Wall Street? I'll call you back tomorrow.
We wanted to make Fatal Attraction, but with more butt cracks.
That's right.
I'm sorry. Okay. But anyway.
Yeah, no, there were butt cracks. We want to do more. Hello. Okay.
This movie made an absurd amount of money.
It was like one of the movies of the year.
It made $352.9 million in the box office. It was the fourth highest grossing movie of 1992. And even that gets adjusted to $238 million domestically when adjusted for inflation, which is pretty impressive.
It's pretty impressive, especially for... It would be more impressive now, but I think it's even impressive then. It is just like, this is just a movie that came out of nowhere. It's not a sequel. It's not a pre-existing thing. It's not a, you know, it's just a movie that came out with 1.5 movie stars in it.
Right.
You know? And it's the word of mouth, I think. I think the movie's sexuality is what really got it on everybody's radar.
Yeah. Well, it got mixed at best reviews. It currently sits at a 56% on Rotten Tomatoes. The critics' consensus is unevenly echoing the work of Alfred Hitchcock. Basic Instinct contains a star-making performance from Sharon Stone, but is ultimately undone by its problematic, overly lurid plot.
Ooh, that's dynamite. I agree with that. That is spot on.
It's pretty good, yeah.
I was going to say, if anything, it doesn't matter. This is all very arbitrary. I think 56% is higher than I might have guessed. It seems a little high. And it's like, again, though, it's fun. It's hard to recommend, but I wouldn't tell you not to watch it either. Like, again, Sharon Stone's really good in there. It's directed pretty well. It's like, you could tell there's little flashes of moments. I don't know.
I'd be willing to wager there are other people like us that just have movie gaps. Like, I don't expect much from this, but I'd like to just see it so I know the source material.
Yeah. And I've always been fascinated by it. It's kind of like a phrase that's thrown around. But like, if you say a true star-making turn that like people in this movie... Well, who's Sharon Stone? And then they come. You know what it is? Jan DeBont. He did it for Sandra Bullock a few years later in Speed.
He's got a gift.
He can do action, but he can also frame the female face and make a star out of him.
It's pretty nice.
Yeah, I love that Jan DeBont. Did we mention, too, I wanted to, just because I see her right there, I'm going to say that, okay? We were laughing just weeks ago at Batman Forever. I was like, it's got nominated for 2 Oscars. I don't know when we're going to do another episode about a movie that's been nominated for Oscars. In a perfect world, Jackass would have won Best Documentary several years over. And I'll make that, not even joke, observation every year that they make one of those movies. Because why not, right? Anyways, this movie nominated for 2 Academy Awards.
Yeah.
2, same as Batman Forever. So I don't even want to say that anymore. That will never happen again. At this point, I'm curious.
What other ones will come up?
Are we going to get one that won some Oscars, that was nominated for more than 2? Let's see. Maybe we'll find the worst reviewed movie that was ever nominated for Best Picture. That might be a fun thing to look into.
Yeah. Mm. So it was nominated for Best Film Editing and Best Original Score, which I found incredibly surprising because one of the things that I thought was the worst about this movie,
like off-putting,
is the soundtrack or the score. I forget who said it, but somebody was talking about what purpose a score is meant to serve, and it's supposed to like highlight the action, whatever's happening, but without overtaking it or telling the viewer how to feel. It's supposed to not distract from it, but like it's like they're supposed to be married, and this completely didn't fit the movie at all. The car chase scene did not sound like a car chase scene.
Yeah. In general, I thought that, I mean, this is kind of unrelated, maybe not. The car chase scene, I remember just saying the car stuff in this movie is like boring. It's bad. It sucks.
The way that the car kind of just looks shitty and keeps hitting.
There's really humorous. Yeah. It's set in San Francisco, which is like a thing that just movies and video games are just all. They've been using that trick forever because there's just hills and fog and there's just a lot of appealing reasons to set car movies and video games there. But yeah, there's like when they're going up the hill, it's not Steve McQueen and Bullet. It looks more like, oh, a guy going over speed bumps or something. It's just not.
It's not cool.
It's not the most slick thing I've ever seen.
And interestingly, the composer, the Oscar nominee, Jerry Goldsmith, he said Basic Instinct was probably the most difficult score I've ever done. It's a very convoluted story with very unorthodox characters. It's a murder mystery, but it isn't really a murder mystery. But he did say, I think it's one of the best scores I've ever written. So he has fond memories of it. That's nice. I think he might say it's a murder mystery, but it isn't really a murder mystery. because you know pretty quickly, like, oh, here's the prime suspect, and now here's an hour and 50 minutes of supporting evidence that this lady is definitely the prime suspect.
Yeah, I think there's something, it's either frustrating or kind of like, it went from frustrating to being funny to me in a way of just everything, every line of dialogue is this loaded thing, which, like, that's writing, that's movies, you know, clues or suspicion or suspense or whatever. But it's just almost humorous where there's just no moments of real people coming through. They're just, you know, it's just like, oh, use an ice pick to stab the glass, huh? Yeah, I like rough edges. And there's just like no moments of like people just like like people. It's just all, I'm a temptress. Well, I'm a fucking recovering alcoholic. You know, it just, yeah, you know, it was just all very, what do you call it? I don't know.
Wooden?
We're kind of just wooden.
It's funny you say that because I pulled a review that makes exactly that point.
Hey. Well, some reviewers are pretty smart, I gotta say. Sometimes they just nail it and they're just right.
They're not all A.O. Scott or whatever that guy's.
Some of them are spot on when they say things that I agree with, though.
Well, to jump ahead a little bit, some of the issues that people had with the movie were its depiction of lesbians and bisexual characters. Mm-hmm. And so Stephen Schiff on Fresh Air in 92 spoke to that, and he said, the least of screenwriter Joe Esterhaz's sins is that Tramiel...
Catherine Tramiel, Sharon Stone's character?
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah.
And all the other female suspects in this movie are lesbian or bisexual. For that to be offensive, we would have to see some connection between their sexual preference and their evil deeds, which is tough when you can't see any connection between these characters and human life on Earth.
Yeah.
And that's a great way to put it, because nobody behaves this way.
It's like, it's not unlike a soap opera or something of just like, it's heightened, but almost by design too. Like, yeah. I was saying the screenplay lacks subtext. Like, yeah, they didn't try it to do something else and fail. Like, that was what they wanted to do, this very loaded, sensual, whatever. Like I said, at some point in the movie, like, this whole movie, I think there's just some, you know, they talk about movies, elevator pitch or whatever. This elevator pitch to me, I bet someone had this idea of like, hey, what if we made some, you know, Cinemax style, like, you know, they didn't say that, but like, you know, this sultry thriller. And at some point, there's like a sex scene, but as a viewer, you're watching the sex, but you also aren't sure if she's going to fucking kill the guy or not. It feels like the whole movie is like that. It's completely. Like, if Godzilla meets King Kong is an idea for a movie, then what if she kills the guy when she's fucking him? Then that feels like this is the big idea that this hangs on.
There's no grander thing at play here, I don't think. I think it's really just that.
Yeah.
And
they work that, back, that they work was, backwards. It's like a mystery, like you write a novel, you know.
That was Paul Verhoeven's vision, though. This He's article art, I yeah. found from The Independent described it as a quick glance at the storyboard sketches proves eye-popping. They're positively pornographic. And Verhoeven was upfront about wanting full frontal.
Quote, dirty notebooks.
And they have a quote from him from a making-of documentary. There was no negotiation about the nudity. He had a vision. God damn it.
This is a movie about sex and violence. You know, it's a tale as old as time. They just had a specific, take on it all.
And it included pubic hair. Apparently.
Pubic hair and butts and ice pick stabbings and everything else.
What a ridiculous fucking movie this is.
Yeah. When should I talk about that scene that made me laugh for 20 minutes?
You can talk about it.
So it's 1992 in the movie, or 91 maybe, I think. Who knows when they're, you know, making it. But regardless, there's a scene. It's a classic cop movie shit where Michael Douglas is on the computer. It's the old style computer. You know, the black screen, green text. I think of an Apple IIe that we used to have in school. I think there's a lot that had that look, but it's pretty primitive by today's standards is all. And he's typing in the very primitive, I don't even know if it's like accurate or they just make up some fake software for the movie, but he's typing in information and getting results about people in the computer database. Mm-hmm. And I really, literally, it was so funny to me because it's funny anyways, but it just went with this thought I had so amazingly where I was just thinking, Because again, it's so primitive. It's just this, like, I'm sitting here, this computer does probably about three things, and I'm doing one of them. You know, it's like, I was like, what a primitive time. The computer's so much more innocent here, you know? It's just this, like, thing. It's like you had a fax machine, a copy, you know, whatever, and your computer you can do some stuff on. It's just much more innocent than this monster that it is now. And then his partner Gus walks in, and I'm going to paraphrase it, but he's like, hey, what are you doing in there? You're jacking off on the thing. It's just like, the assumption is that he's in there doing, like, dirty stuff on it.
That's always been our instinct.
That's always been the thing with, like, I don't even know. You just
what could you possibly be
reading
doing?
Reading about, like, people getting arrested for public nudity or something? What is the allegation exactly? I thought it was so funny. It was one of those things where, like, we laughed and then you looked at me later and it was kind of that, like, you're still laughing about that. Just like, it's just.
But also the dialogue in the movie is just absurd. So it was just a lot of different factors.
It really just floored me that as I was thinking about, man, what a simpler time. Nope, not according to Gus. Gus jacks off of that computer and he thinks other people do too. That's the most troubling part for me.
Ain't you got nothing better to do than come in here and jack off the damn machine?
What do you do here, cowboy?
Came in here to jack off the damn machine.
Yeah.
Shameful.
There is a part too because Catherine, the Sharon Stone character, is a novelist, mm-hmm. printing a novel, and it's very suspenseful. The old style printer, you could really do that in a suspenseful when the thing goes back and forth, and you know, it's really just it's a time capsule. That shit, it's great.
Yeah. So when very early on in the movie, since the very first scene in the movie is the mid-coitus murder,
you get it all right there. All their cards.
Of a rock star whose girlfriend is Catherine Tremell, a trashy crime novelist who just so happened to have written a book about somebody who murders their man in that exact same way.
And that is her man. And she is just like, yeah, but that wasn't me. He was having sex with some other lady that did that, essentially, right?
She's like, would I really be stupid enough to...
Yeah.
Commit a murder exactly like a book I had written.
Exactly.
I'm paraphrasing.
Yeah.
But so she comes up on the police radar, not literally. They go see her pretty quickly into the process, and she tells Michael Douglas that she's writing a book about a detective that falls to the wrong woman, and he asks what happened, and she just says she kills him. Hmm. So then that's sort of what we're doing here, and it's like, it's just very, it's all very comical because... So here's a woman who only kills people that she's having sex with actively.
Perhaps.
We think.
Accusedly.
Possibly.
Allegedly.
Allegedly. Wouldn't an easy way to avoid being murdered for Michael Douglas, the homicide detective, simply be to stay away from this woman?
Yeah.
Not fuck the... person you're pursuing?
That's kind of Gus's whole thing, right?
He's a really bad cop.
Yeah.
Michael Douglas.
He's a really bad cop, and not even in a way that sometimes bad cops come through and you're like, I like this guy.
Right. He's not redeemable
he's not
at all.
Dude. He's very weak, you know? Like, he's portrayed as someone who is, I mean, you know, people fight their demons and everything else, but, it's just like, I don't know, people just pretty point blank for all the reasons you just said are just like, again, paraphrasing. It's like, dude, I don't think you should get mixed up with this girl. Hey, I'm going to get mixed up with her. Also, can I get some booze down here? Because I'm breaking my newfound sobriety. And again, his friends are just like, hey, you sure, man? Like, from that point of view of like, we're drinking too, so we can't say too much, but everything you're doing just seems like a disaster. And
you find out that he's in recovery. And he's on shaky ground with the police force because he killed two people while on duty.
In a shootout, innocent, friendly fire, right?
Tourists. Two tourists.
Some tourists. One second you're taking a picture. Next minute, Michael Douglas is shooting. You're going, ah, there's no way I don't get suspended for that. and then he's in some sort of internal affairs assigned psychology. And he's with the psychologist.
Yeah, so there's a Dr. Melfi type role. Yeah. This was, you know, like... almost a decade before.
We don't think The Sopranos ripped it off from here. But
no, just not... more for reference's sake. Like, except for she's no Dr. Melfi.
And they get together.
Yeah.
which I would have to think compromises some of the mental therapy, the work you do.
Oh, I'd say so.
When you are also, you know, having that weird basic instinct sex.
Amazingly, there was a bidding war over this script.
It was a hot script. Joe Esterhaz was a hot screenwriter. Joe Esterhaz, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. He was like one of the guys for a minute there.
It's kind of bonkers. So he ended up selling the rights to Carol Co. Pictures for $3 million. $3 million. $3 million American human dollars.
Words on a page.
For Basic Instinct.
Yeah.
That's inspirational.
And really. Then they have sex with each other. I mean, there's more to it than that.
And there's a mystery, but not really.
But this is like, you think about, this is a smutty screenplay. Paul Verhoeven had his smutty storyboards. And hey, man, it's an R rating. Party time. I'm just saying.
After, it was NC-17 until he cut 40 seconds out.
That's what you do. You probably throw in the most heinous stuff. And then when you dial it down, you're just left with what you wanted.
Pretty
fun. It's an old trick.
Oh, but if you couldn't believe it, the script for this movie that inspired a bidding war and earned a man $3 million, it was written in 13 days.
It's inspiring, right?
And I guess he lied about it. I found Joe Esterhaz's 10 golden rules of screenwriting, and they're as great as you can imagine. But for brevity's sake, we'll just talk about number 6. Always lie about your first draft. I told people I'd been working on the script of Basic Instinct for years when I sold it for a record price. When the movie became the biggest hit of 1992, I told the truth. It had taken me 13 days to write it.
Yeah. You know, there's some real, he talks about, you know, it's a real, the kind of guy that would talk like that is also the kind of guy who's like, hey, no disrespect, you have the fourth biggest hit. But now when he's talking, he's like, hey, when it became the biggest hit of the year, I was like, well, okay. It wasn't the biggest hit of the year, it was the fourth, which is great. But also, it's like...
Writers should be accurate.
Rule number 8, never miss a chance to inflate yourself. Probably, I haven't looked at all the rules, but I feel like that probably ties into one of the others or something.
Yeah, they're all worth following, I would imagine. Mm-hmm. And a detail that I thought was just perfect. So Esterhaz and his writing partner, who also served as a producer on the movie, Irvin Winkler, they left production over a disagreement with Paul Verhoeven. He wanted to make the film more sexually explicit by adding a lesbian love sex scene and showing body parts, quote, in various stages of excitement.
Okay.
I'm not sure what that means. I'm glad that they didn't provide further details.
I know what it means.
Oh, boy. Okay. But Esterhaz said that when he wrote the script, he wanted it to be a psychological mystery with the love scenes done subtly. Every love scene begins with the words, it's dark. We can't see clearly. And boy, did that go out the window at some point.
There's nothing subtle about it. There's some things you see in this picture that are not subtle.
Agreed.
There's some parts...
In various issues
of Michael Douglas you see.
Yeah, there's a silhouette of Michael Douglas you see at one point where it's like, whoa, dude, I don't... Okay, good for you, I guess, but come on.
I said they could have called this movie Ball Street at one point.
Okay.
Look it.
Here we go.
And now.
So then Gary Goldman was subsequently brought on board to rewrite the script 4 times at Verhoeven's suggestion. However, by the 4th draft, Verhoeven himself acknowledged that his proposals were undramatic and really stupid. By the 5th and final draft, the script had returned to Esterhaz's original vision with only minor tweaks to visuals and dialogue. And that's why Joe Esterhaz is the sole writing credit on the movie.
That's so funny. Yeah, it just says written by Joe Esterhaz, but they took the long way there.
They rewrote the movie so many times they ended up with the same thing.
They just threw it out and were like, fuck this, back to square one. We didn't know how good this was, or at least hard to fix, or you know, like they're like something's off here, but we couldn't come up with anything better.
It's like
the result they got to.
You get it into your head that the couch would be better in a different spot, so when you move it all around, you go, nothing's actually,
right. Yeah, nothing's right. Yep, you're right. This is a couch of a movie.
Except for this is $49 million.
Yeah, but wow. it made like $300 billion.
Yep.
Sharon Stone, Michael Douglas, Wayne Knight.
Amazing, really.
Mm-hmm.
So the infamous interrogation scene was all shot in one day, which I thought was substantial just because It's not very much time.
Yeah, it's one scene, but there's a lot of different shots and a lot of different people and lines and just a lot going on. It's lit in a very specific sort of way and all that. So yeah, they did good work, I guess. I think later I saw, not to skip all over, but in your notes, I saw later they talk about some love scene taking 2 days.
Yeah.
And I just remember thinking, oh, geez, you'd think you'd want to just, like, get that shit done as quick as you can. So just, yeah, I guess at least they only made Sharon Stone do this for a day. I don't know.
So there's actually a point of contention with how much of Sharon Stone is exposed. She maintains that she had no idea her private parts would be visible while on camera. But Paul Verhoeven has disputed this. Mm-hmm. So they have two completely different recollections of what's going on there. But she's been consistent because she's been complaining about this since like 93.
Really, you know, I don't have anything profound to add, but it's a really fucked up thing to have two different perspectives on when you're talking about, you know, not to put it bluntly, but you showed my genitals in a movie that everyone in America saw, or quite a few, you know. If the allegation is that you did it on my permission, that's not great.
Yeah, so in her 2021 memoir called The Beauty of Living Twice, she got into it a little bit. She said, she claimed Verhoeven had asked her to remove her underwear for the scene because he could see a flash of white in the shot. He assured her that all the audiences would see is a shadow. She saw a playback of the footage, and in the pre-digital age, it looked fine.
Mm.
But then she saw the scene properly at a preview screening with an audience.
Big screen, though, yeah.
Yeah, and she described storming into the production booth and slapped Verhoeven across the face. Mm. Verhoeven has denied the story, calling Stone's version of the events nonsense. But Stone was talking to the press even back in 92 about how the scene was more explicit than she'd signed up for.
Well, now
Verhoeven, for his part, has described his memory of the events as radically different. In a 2021 interview with Variety, he said she knew exactly what we were doing.
Okay.
So there's just no agreement there. And interestingly, so the scene is her character being interrogated, and she's sort of using her body to distract the cops, basically, is the point of it all.
Mm-hmm.
And this is exemplified by Wayne Knight's cherubic face. he described himself as being gigantically overweight at the time and said he didn't realize that his face would fill a frame. But that one day of filming, because he's only in that one scene, really changed a lot for him. So basically that his part in that scene became part of the trailer, and then that trailer became part of like the zeitgeist.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody knew that visual. And apparently his role in Basic Instinct got him cast in Jurassic Park. Steven Spielberg once said he stayed through the end credits to find his name specifically to give him the part in Jurassic Park. I found that very significant, that because of his face reacting to Sharon Stone.
And then it being like in the trailer and so prominent, kind of like with that. Again, he's in one scene, but he's also in the scene.
Right.
That was good. Good for him.
You ever engage in any sadomasochistic activity?
Exactly what did you have in mind, Mr. Corelli?
The scene had ramifications. It helps Wayne Knight, but Sharon Stone, it was a mixed bag for her because the whole part like launched her into a different sort of stratosphere. I watched an interview of hers from the David Letterman show where she was just talking about how suddenly she's being stopped on the streets and she can't figure out, like, are you somebody I went to high school with? Are you a distant relative? Like, she was that unknown and then that recognizable.
Yeah.
So it was very instantaneous, at least as boiled down to a short late night interview in 1992.
That is, you're right. They boil down those segments are short, but nevertheless, it sounds like it, you know, plausible.
But then not too long ago, she did some podcast where she said that she lost custody of her child because of her nudity in that movie. She said, when the judge asked my child, my tiny little tiny boy, do you know your mother makes sex movies? That's kind of fucked up.
It's fucked up.
And she was nominated for a Golden Globe for her performance in the movie. And she says that when she went to the Golden Globes and they called her name, bunch of people in the room laughed.
It's fucked up. It's fucked up. The thing with the judge, I mean, it's this isn't even the point at all, but whether she has that scene with her legs or not, you could still call that a sex movie if you were being unfair.
Of course.
So, but nevertheless, I mean, yeah, it's just, it's tough because, you know, it can be a lot, it can, the same thing can be different, you know, it could be this movie everyone saw, but then also at the heart of it is Sharon Stone taking kind of the hit or whatever, certainly from a vulnerability standpoint of like, oh, it's a movie everyone's talking about. However, your personal reputation is now a little, you're the lady that did this weird thing.
It was just
in the movie we all liked.
It's,
you know?
So, right, exactly that. Like, this movie made a shitload of money. We all know who you are. We will see this white dress interrogation room scene redone on a million things. The Nanny, The Simpsons, WrestleMania fucking 21 or whatever. Mm-hmm. Like, it was redone everywhere, but she was still the butt of the joke. Just like, reviews said things like, Sharon Stone can act? Who knew? It's like, well, nobody knew who she was before, but just like people, it was this weird thing where it's like, we will all prop you up and celebrate and support the thing you put out there, whether it's Sharon Stone or Pamela Anderson or whatever, but we're also going to look down our nose at you and talk shit about you because of what you do that we all spend money on. Mm-hmm. It just doesn't make any sense.
Mm-hmm.
You can't shame somebody for doing something and then make them a success. Like, it's only money that makes these people successes. It's just weird.
Yeah. And it was a thing, too. I mean, it's not new. It's not going away, sadly. But it was really just, like, maybe hyper going on for a while in the 90s or something. This sort of, like, it's misogyny, but it's also just, like, it's, like, horned-up misogyny. Where I was just writing about it for my bizarre day job, but I was writing about a Duke Nukem video game. And it's like there's some wisecrack about, like, it's like that. And the thing I wrote was just like, it's from this snapshot, this moment in time where, like, a lot of the discussion in pop culture was like how hot Britney Spears and the Spice Girls were and how we also, like, wish they would fucking die or something. It was like a really weird, whoa, okay, like,
yeah.
I understand that there's always going to be sex symbols and stuff like that, but it was that weird, like, again, like, we all fucking thought Basic Instinct was cool, but Sharon Stone became a bit of a punchline of it all, but it's like, what the fuck? Yeah, I don't know. It's fucked up. Sorry, Sharon. Sorry, Spice Girls.
She was GQ's Woman of the Year in, like, 2019, and I watched her speech on YouTube while doing research for the podcast, and she kind of just, like, recreated that moment and just said that while it upset her when she finally saw it on a big screen and realized what was going on.
What we're doing here.
She said that she just embraced it because, it was like an opportunity she seized. And then she spoke to how, like, you will have these opportunities and it'll be up to you how you react and you will be held accountable and that's your responsibility to shoulder that as well. Mm-hmm. But she basically just said, thank you for giving me this honor because for years that was the joke.
Mm-hmm.
Just like, man, that's a lot of weight for one person to carry. And it's just fucked up that it just seems like every few years for a time there was just a new woman that became the butt of that joke.
Yeah.
And I'm glad that so many people are realizing that now, but you do still see that. So just like, maybe you should just not be so harsh towards people like that.
Mm-hmm.
This is just really unfair and it does get back to them somehow.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
But anyway, the beaver picture.
Yeah. Not without its controversy beyond just that scene. Well, I don't even know if that scene, I guess it's controversy in the sense of fucking judge giving her shit at the thing or whatever, but larger controversy, the production, because this was a hot script, so people got their hands on this script by and large before it was, so they were the people that got angry about the movie. You know, oftentimes you hear about, like, a release being picketed, but they were like, no, fuck you, don't make this movie,
right?
Which is pretty, you know, that doesn't happen every day.
So the controversy section of the Wikipedia is the most verbose on the whole page
of all the sections
which is, I thought, significant. And there's like two subsections. There's there's at the time, and then there's renewed deals mostly with Sharon Stone's perspective on that whole scene.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And then the contemporary section is all about the protests that disrupted production. And it was basically at the start of production, activist groups like Queer Nation, the Gay and Lesbian Alliance Against Defamation, they all took issue with it being another movie that pits gay and lesbian characters against heterosexuals and makes those characters into the villains.
Mm.
Basically, was the issue. So somehow, before production, the script had made the rounds and groups were already upset about it for these reasons. And so people from activist groups like Queer Nation, ACT UP, and GLAAD met with Joe Esterhaas, Paul Verhoeven, and producer Alan Marshall, and they demanded script revisions. They wanted, among other things, for Nick Kieran, Michael Douglas's character, to be changed into a female character, and they wanted a certain scene. They wanted the date rape scene removed between Michael Douglas's character and the psychologist character played by Gene Triplehorn.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, so we got to talk about it because it's, I don't know how it read in 92, but it's uncomfortable. It's uncomfortable to watch because it's not played like. It's not played like an assault. It's I have a quote from NPR here because I liked the way that they put it. It says, it occurs between Michael Douglas's character and psychologist Dr. Beth Garner, played by Gene Triplehorn. It's not treated as sexual assault, however. After it's over, Dr. Beth Garner is merely disappointed by what she deems as unexpectedly rough sex, while Nick more or less shrugs it off as being in the heat of the moment. And that's kind of it. Yeah, it happens, mm-hmm. and then she's a little bit like, what was that all about? And mm-hmm. then that's kind of it. Like, then scenes later, she's helping him out and smiling, waving at
yeah.
him.
Yeah. Yeah, even if it forked in the road and she was just like, I don't want to talk to you anymore or something, there would at least be, like, some sort of, like, lingering that wasn't okayness. But, yeah, it's like, yeah.
Yeah, it's really just like he gets all horned up from the interrogation with a...
Yeah, the scene.
Yeah, it's
an iconic scene, and he was there for it live.
Because they talk about how she likes to be tied up or whatever, or tie people up. That, so all of these lurid conversations happen, all these details happen in the scene. And then he sort of takes it out on the woman he's already in a relationship with or mm-hmm. whatever. But mm-hmm. it's just very, it's hard to move past.
Mm-hmm.
And I have never heard of one single solitary citizen's arrest happening on a film set, let alone some 30, whatever we read. 31 demonstrators.
Gosh.
there's a Variety headline from May 6, 1991. Citizen's arrests on Basic Instinct set.
That's hardcore. That's how you protest. You just start arresting people and then, you know, we forget that we have that power.
Well.
To just arrest people. You probably shouldn't wield it
with
recklessly.
A little bit of context. Production had been granted a temporary restraining order against the protesters, and they had ordered them to remain at least 100 feet away. Or they weren't allowed within 100 feet of production, mm-hmm. of filming.
Mm-hmm.
But they violated the order, and they confronted police and tried interrupting production by chanting slogans such as "Hollywood, you stink," and they blew whistles.
That's pretty harsh.
They also at various points one night they splattered paint and made outdoor sets unusable. Filming had to be relocated while they repaired damage.
That's actually a pretty good one. I was busting their balls, but that's a pretty good one.
On the night they were filming a car chase. The car chase that we were talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Demonstrators returned, this time waving American flags and signs advising unsuspecting motorists to honk their horns if they love the local 49ers football team or if they support the U.S. troops.
Man, that's a home run right there. That's so funny. Not to mix sports, but holy shit. Especially because I pointed out, too, they're out in California doing the 49ers in the early 90s, so that wasn't hard to get people to hoop and holler for them.
I'm sure they were very excited.
And then the troops a few years after the Gulf War, they were playing the hits right there. That's really solid.
It's pretty diabolical, very smart. However, not the most effective thing to do it, unfortunately, because they're filming a car chase.
They don't need the sound?
Yeah, they probably would just pipe in stuff after the fact.
Yeah, that sucks. Everyone is like... on both sides laughing. Yeah. Got them. They're like, they didn't get us. But everyone went home happy that night. At least there's that. Maybe there's some beauty there.
And additionally, they got pissed off at a local business owner who let them film at his nightclub. This guy Ray Chalker, who owned a gay and lesbian country and western bar called Rawhide 2.
Okay.
he rented his facility to Carol Co for filming, and within 2 weeks after that, his bar was picketed, his property was vandalized, and signs were posted around the neighborhood reading "Kill Ray."
Oh my God!
In April 1991, he told the LA Times that he has had threats on my voicemail, constant harassment, super glue put into the locks of my home, and vandalism to my $80,000 Mercedes.
Well, some people just don't like your Mercedes. You always run that chance, but nevertheless, that's too far.
While reading about this, I was like, how did this guy get the worst of all this?
Right, because he hosted a film shoot of a movie whose script portrayed some lesbians and bisexuals to be the villain.
Mm-hmm.
If I'm understanding, I'm not trying to be condescending. I'm just trying to follow here.
This was his transgression. But I don't know. Paul Verhoeven at the time, at least, was Teflon Don in it, and really just not accepting any of the criticism. He said, "I was, you might say, politically correct. The gay characters are positive, and the reaction is totally unwarranted. Have they seen the film? No. They read the script. They read the script like fundamentalists read the Bible. They could not visualize the film. They didn't know how many butt cracks I was going to put in
the That's picture. Right. That's the problem. Maybe it wasn't clear in the script or something, too. I don't know.
That's too bad.
Yeah.
But it didn't. It actually, this isn't the last of the protesters.
Mm.
Production stopped. They wrapped the movie. But it, people still kept
on protesting.
Yeah. So after production ended, they launched a campaign called Blank Did It, spoiling the movie without
mm-hmm.
a blank.
Mm-hmm.
Character's name here.
Mm-hmm.
And they put up a billboard. They made T-shirts and stickers and pamphlets and handed them out to people to spoil the ending so that they wouldn't go see the movie.
They tried to soil the whole movie so people would be like, well, I don't want to go see the movie. I know who the killer is at the end.
Yeah.
Which, I don't know, maybe people are like that. I just don't know. It seems like a stretch.
Yeah, it seems like it actually might have had the opposite effect.
It's funny as hell, don't get me wrong. It's really funny.
It's hilarious, and I cannot believe that this movie inspired so much effort. So much effort.
People got really fired up about this movie.
A March 1992 Hollywood Reporter item speculated that the controversy only contributed to the opening weekend box office.
I just was going to say, everyone's just talking about this movie. Everyone's going to go see this movie that you have to believe. And I'm sure it got, I heard this movie where fucking you can see this or that. Or, you know, I can only imagine.
It was the second biggest opening weekend after Wayne's World.
Look at that.
That's ridiculous. So many people went to see this movie.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, and
it was doing Wayne's World numbers.
A few weeks into the movie's theatrical run, Sharon Stone hosted Saturday Night Live.
Oh, yeah.
And she parodied the interrogation scene, of course, in her opening monologue. According to reports following the broadcast, hecklers could be heard interrupting Stone during her monologue in protest of the film's misogyny and depiction of lesbian and bi villains. The show continued, and 6 people were arrested. NBC replaced that version of the monologue with footage from the dress rehearsal for reruns of the episode.
Wow. 6 people were arrested because they were so fired up about Basic Instinct. All the respect in the world. Hats off to you and your passion. You got arrested because you were so fired up about Basic Instinct. You went and harassed Sharon Stone at the live comedy taping that was also on NBC. Like, you fucked up the whole TV show and this whole, like, you know, again, just making sure I got all my facts straight.
I cannot believe that this movie inspired so much. So many strong feelings.
And it's just like a bad movie about Michael Douglas, like, fucking everyone.
Yeah. That's it.
Kind of it. And his friends are like, don't fuck her. And he's like, I think I'm going to fuck her.
Like, we joked about this, but it sounds like they really did want to make Fatal Attraction, but, like, even sexier.
Yeah.
And that's what this is.
Yeah.
And it just, it's so funny that, like, it really just becomes what you make of it. Because as we've discussed recently,
mm-hmm.
it's sort of now it's standing. It's like some people regard it as like it's actually a feminist movie,
yeah.
and Sharon Stone's bisexual femme fatale, is she a murderer, is she not, I don't know, like that she's become like a queer icon is yeah. one of the biggest or like one of the earliest mainstream representations, and it's all very, I just It's just all very interesting that it means so much to so many different groups of people.
Yeah.
And it's the exact opposite opinion.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's all very interesting. It's like, it's a mirror.
It's something. It's like one of those ink blot tests, or it's something like, because, yeah, I don't know. It's like, I don't want to say everything can be done. You can't do this to everything, but it is just funny where, I don't know. I guess I just don't have that kind of brain where you start to say, well, this movie seems to think that all the bisexual people in the world are evil or something. I just don't make that leap to like, well, what is this movie saying about the world? It's like, I think they just like tried to write a good story. And they're like, hey, you've seen other movies. So sometimes a movie zigs and ours is going to zag. And I don't even mean this movie in particular. I just mean that practice of like,
completely.
Well, this movie seems to think that everyone in the world should be distrustful of it. It's like, well, because one character worked at this kind of store. We shouldn't, we're, you know, like just like one detail suddenly is like, it's a movie. You don't get 5 years of television. You get 90 minutes to tell a story. So like, sadly, if there's like one female character, it doesn't necessarily become an essay on
all females.
Yeah, exactly. Like that might not be the role of that character.
Right.
And I think that's fine. But once you start getting intellectual with it, I guess it can be a fucking feminist icon or it can be absolute devil shit. You know, I don't know.
Yeah. I liked the way Elvis Mitchell on NPR's Weekend Edition in spring of 1992. At the time, I think he captured it pretty well. He said, I think the activists are sort of missing the point. I don't think the movie is just anti-gay or misogynist. I think it's misanthropic.
Yeah.
It's not some people it's had a problem with. It just thinks all humans are bad.
It is kind of, you know, like, it certainly didn't get originated in the 90s, but I think there's like a bleakness to a lot of what were actually very popular movies in the 90s. Like, one of them is... Like, you go back to, like, Seven. Like, that is, like, the darkest, most twisted movie. And it was a huge hit. The star power and stuff helped. But things like that and this are, like, fucked up, violent movies that were really, really big hits.
Mm-hmm.
And it is, like, that misanthrope. It's, like, this is just a dark, scummy movie. And I don't mean in an insulting way. I just mean, like, it exists in a world where, like, there aren't good and bad people. This isn't that kind of... It ain't that kind of movie, kid, as we say around here. It's just like a dark, twisted, you know, little thing about fucking and killing or whatever, you know?
Yeah.
I don't think it's got some axe to grind against a minority group necessarily. And if you want to argue that there's an irresponsibility to the representation when they could have used more representation that, oh, well, they're just always the killers and there's always a thing, I get that, sure.
If you had a more diverse group of people working on the movie, that would help. And these are things that, like, have... been corrected. Like, it's not, you're gonna get a more wide perspective on things because you have people from all different kinds of backgrounds coming and making shit now,
right?
And maybe the lesson here is like, if your movie is inspiring so much negative feelings and sentiments from the groups that it's about, maybe it's worth at least taking this into account a little bit.
But it is just
interesting that we've been having the same arguments collectively as a society for at least 30 years.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I think there's something about that scene, too, of the scene itself takes on this context. Everything we've talked about, the scene is about Sharon Stone going, yeah, you're not going to pay attention to fucking anything else because I do this.
Right.
Or at the very least, I'm going to kind of manipulate you a little bit or something because of what I'm doing, exposing myself to you in this sexual world, is going to be like the dominant thing, you know, and now I have all the power and stuff like that. And that's like kind of what happened in real life a little bit. Like, you know, it was like the men of the world collectively were Wayne Knight sweating and their jaws hit the ground and everything else. But also, it is just like there's a self-awareness to that scene that is echoed later in its reception.
And
right?
She also even speaks to that a little bit in the movie itself. Like after her character, Michael Douglas' character, become involved, she tells him, I don't know if I have the words exactly, but like, I'm not going to tell you all my secrets just because I have an orgasm. Like, you're only going to know what I want you to know.
Yeah.
And it's like, as the audience, we know that to be true. Like, this guy is completely in over his head.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of cool, that power dynamic. It's just like, I think when you say it's hard to picture anybody else playing that, because it's hard to picture anybody else being able to exude that, like, I'm in charge here without even really doing much.
Right. I guess that's maybe what I was getting at, too. It's like, in that scene, she is so aware that people aren't going to, like, you're not going to get past this. This is going to be the defining thing of this interaction. And that really became true of, like, it as a movie, as, yeah. as a whole, you know. But also, it's like, well, then you also put it in the marketing and everything else. So those decisions were made along the way to also really go hard with it, mm-hmm. you know. But, yeah.
Yeah. And it's interesting, sort of the femme fatale through line of, like, maybe the first example is Adam and Eve. Mm-hmm. And then you might think, like, hard-boiled detective shit from the 1940s.
Mm-hmm.
And then if you follow that all the way to 1992, I think that's how you end up with Catherine Trebell.
I think so. Yeah, that sounds right. But Kathy.
And Paul Verhoeven imagined Catherine to be, like, the literal devil, I guess, is what he was going for. Again, some people use subtext, and some people just, like, waste of time.
Don't care for it. That's right.
Waste of fucking time. Mm-hmm. Also, an obvious point here is, as The Independent put it, true noir style, Basic Instinct is a phallic Freudian nightmare. Because Michael Douglas, through being a bad cop in various ways, he gets his gun taken away.
Oh, dick stuff.
And somebody's coming around with an ice pick penetrating all these men.
Oh my God.
Oh boy.
Wow. You're not safe from the phallic interpretations. That's what I think about sometimes. It's like, so what, just go light everyone on fire? And like, no, it's dick stuff. Maybe it is. Maybe it is. Just saying. I don't know.
Yeah.
There's only so many ways to kill a guy. And if you're going to do it quietly, a lot of them are going to be fucking pokey. I don't know what to tell you. You know?
Yeah.
I guess you could strangle a guy. I guess if you ever write a movie about murder and you innocently think, oh, those stabs are careful, that might be read as a sexy thing. So just make sure they choke him. Although then choking, that's got some.
Yeah, you're right.
You know, you could say, oh, pretty heavy duty way to kill someone when you could have just stabbed him. Why so sexual? You know, that's what I think. You get enough scholars, you turn them loose, everyone's going to get every point made out of everything. And
I guess when you make stuff, and you have to just be okay with that possibility that people are going to interpret this however they want to.
That's just got to be the byproduct. Not even the byproduct, but like the consequence, the result, I don't know, of a lot of people see your shit. It's just the end result is some people are going to misinterpret it. I don't know who is misinterpreting it, but someone's going to misinterpret it. And go, what? That's not it at all.
Mm-hmm. So where does this leave us now in 2023 with Basic Instinct? It seems like now it's conceived as pure joyous trash. Perhaps not so joyous, depending on who you are.
Yeah.
Even Paul Verhoeven has since conceded that it's a nonsense movie.
It's fair.
It's elevated by the fact that it's shot by Jan de Bont, and my opinion on its soundtrack is not the defining one. It is Oscar nominated.
You're not in the Academy. You don't see eye to eye with the Academy on that one.
It's one of the only universally praised things about it.
Yeah.
There is a Basic Instinct 2.
I know very little about this, but I just saw earlier that it lost a lot of money, is all I really know.
It was supposed to start production in 2001. It did not. In 2001, Sharon Stone agreed to come back, but Paul Verhoeven and Michael Douglas both said no. Production wanted Benjamin Bratt to be the male lead. But Sharon Stone had final say on her co-star, and she didn't go in for Benjamin Bratt so much.
86 on Ben Bratt.
Yep. And then Robert Downey Jr., who was still in a more troubled phase.
Yeah.
He was offered the role, but he said no.
He said no.
Yeah. And then it eventually came out in like 2012, I think.
I saw it cost them, I forget what I read, $70 million or something insane. I mean, she made 15, so there you go. That's a start, right? Excuse me. It was rough.
Wowzers.
Probably should have left it all at, you know, hindsight's 2020, of course. But Basic Instinct 2, I don't know.
Doing cursory research here, Basic Instinct 2 had a budget of $70 million.
I'm telling you.
Box office, 38.6.
I'm telling you. I lost a bunch of money. So there you go. I think you should watch it if you think it sounds like fun. It's a trashy movie. Even with it being a trashy movie, it's over 2 hours. I could have done with one or two less scenes of them asking someone something and then they drive somewhere. Like I said, the Law and Order sequences of just like policemen doing police. And I like the busy scenes in the police station where all the cops are yelling at each other. I love shit like that. But more, like I said, the two guys out doing cop stuff. It just, one or two too many scenes. Probably one or two too many sex scenes. Ultimately, I get that there have to be some, but it's just like the movie runs a few more laps than it has to, I think.
We joked about this because it's often the tell of a bad movie or TV show when they show you characters drive up in a car, get out of the car,
arriving, walking, right, where
it's like, why didn't you just show them going to the door? Why do we need
like,
all this?
Yeah, you'll never ever watch a movie and be like, yeah, they live up the road on 2nd Street, and then if there's just a quick cut to a knock on the door, and then you know, I mean, well, what the fuck? Where'd they fucking park on 2nd Street or not? Like, that would never, that's never gonna happen.
Just what's show happened?
Me. You can just get there. That's fine. But no, I mean,
there's so much of that. It's
they're a little too
far
much
too
of
long.
It. Yeah, yeah. If you take out the nudity and the overlong stuff and the awkward car chases, there's some pretty funny dialogue in the 12 minutes that remain. There's some pretty good scenes with Gus.
Oh, I forgot to mention, no news broadcasts exist that covered the citizens' arrests on the set, unfortunately.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
But I did find one picture of an old lady protesting, and she had a sign that said, "Basic instinct basically stinks."
There you go.
Isn't that adorable?
Not the worst way to end it, I don't think. I don't know. Do you have anything else we should say? One of our dogs wants to, you know, knock something over or anything before we're done.
I mean, at this rate, they've been...
Oh, here we go. We'll go for a walk.
The special edition DVD, the collector's edition, came with an ice pick pen.
Oh, that's pretty slick.
That's more of
that's
a fun
great.
Fact.
We need more. That's the thing. When we lose physical media, we also lose fun little knickknacks.
I didn't.
That went with them.
I don't like this movie, and I still kind of want to buy
the ice pick thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's fun.
It's just an absurd thing. And we, if nothing else, are fans of the absurd.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for hanging out with us while we talked about Basic Instinct.
I hope it was the podcast of the century.
We never said fuck of the century.
Yeah, I was trying to not.
She's brilliant!